But as usual, I wasn't wearing a shoulder harness on this occasion. And, of course, I paid the penalty for it in getting a cut which began right about level with the outside of my left eye and went up over my forehead and I suppose 4 or 5 inches across the top of my head. Then there was a second cut parallel to the first, which began about the hairline and goes back 4 or 5 inches. It was rather amusing when, many months later, the operations officer was making a survey of the pilots as to which ones wore shoulder harness and which ones did not. And when he came to me, he looked at me and said, "Well, I know why you do." Anyway, to return to the story, when the airplane came to a halt, I was convinced that the belly tank was still on and that the thing was going to catch on fire, and I wanted to get out. But I couldn't see because blood was running all down my face and sort of blinding me. And when I tried to open the canopy, which opens with a crank, the crank just spun free. The cable apparently had broken or something, and it wouldn't open, and I started to sort of panic, thinking I was trapped in there, though there is an escape panel on the side. But when I reached up to the canopy itself, to this escape panel, I found that the canopy just rolled right back effortlessly without any cranking or anything else. So I got out of the airplane, parachute and all, and I think jumped down on the wing and then down on the ground, and there was no fire. And at that point I felt extremely tired, and I thought, I'm just going to go lie down in the grass and take a nap. And and I was about to do that. Probably was suffering from shock because I was extremely cold. I remember that. I was shivering. It was anything but a cold day. However, this whole episode, incident, had been witnessed by two anti-aircraft gunners, two boys who were manning an anti-aircraft gun on the hillside nearby, and apparently they had started to run down towards the airplane immediately because before I could lie down in the grass and take a nap, they came up to me and put their arms around me or something. And I wasn't in any particular pain, not that it felt good, but it wasn't terribly painful. Yeah, but one of them looked at me and he said, "Oh, Jesus Christ." Made me immediately think that indeed, the injuries must be a great deal worse than I thought. Anyway, they each one put an arm around me, and they walked me up the hill to their camp. And nobody seemed to quite know what to do, which is odd. And somebody brought me a cup of coffee and some water to wash my face. And anyway, it was only a matter of minutes before somebody came up there with an ambulance and drove me down to Port Moresby, where there was located the 10th Evacuation Hospital, which is a very large hospital. The hospital, incidentally, consisted of nothing but tents. There were no buildings there that I remember. But that's neither here nor there. They got me down, and it was a long, rough ride, and I was freezing cold all the way. And they got me down there, and some people came out and took me into an operating tent or something. And I remember this doctor asked me if I'd been shot, and I said I hadn't. And anyway, they gave me some anesthetic, because I remember the doctor told me, and I want you to start counting backwards from 10 down, and I got to about 7 or something. That was the last I remembered. And when I woke up, I was in this huge, long tent. Had beds, army cots they were, down either side on the ground. There was no floor. I think there wasn't any floor. It was just dirt. Maybe there was a floor, but I doubt it. It was just a long tent with these rows of beds down both sides and an aisle down the middle. And, of course, my head was all bandaged, and I was a little bit delirious at first. And I don't remember what I said exactly, but I remember that one of the patients in a bed near mine, or whatever it was, he found it terribly amusing and used to laugh and joke about it all the time afterwards. Well, eventually, people, the nurse came around, this and that, and I don't know. Most of the patients in there were infantry men who had been wounded over in Buna, in that area. And I remember a few days later, they brought in the whole crew from a B-25 which had crashed. And the pilot was the most injured. He was unconscious most of the time. For days. And I remember thinking, you know, you can just wear somebody out in a few seconds with a trauma if it's big enough. And that guy, the pilot of that B-25, slept for 3 or 4 days. They'd wake him up and get a little food in him, and he'd go right back to sleep, and slept all day and all night, day in, for 3 or 4 days. Amazing. Anyway, the doctor came along eventually, who had sewed up my head. I cannot remember his name, and it's too bad, but the main medical staff of that hospital was made up of doctors and nurses from Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. And the doctor was very reluctant to let me get out of bed for any reason. I felt fine, but I think there's danger of blood clots forming in cases like that, and you can let people get around and become very active and dislodge those clots, and you got troubles. I think that was it. He never said. Anyway, I finally was able to talk him into letting me get up once every morning and go walk a short distance to another tent or something, to a latrine. I didn't want to go to the bathroom on a bedpan and all that stuff. And I think against his better judgment, I know he was quite reluctant, but the doctor agreed that, okay, once a day I could go up there to the latrine, in which I did. The rest of the time I lay in bed. And I must say, I received an incredible amount of attention. Early that evening after supper, several people from the squadron appeared. And, of course, they wanted to know what happened, because it seems that somebody who was supposed to go on this mission had aborted at the last minute and didn't go. And then whatever the problem was quickly solved, and he took off and joined the formation soon after. And so the squadron leader thought that he was I. And the long and short of it was, they were missing one man and didn't know it. But they knew it on the ground, apparently, and because messages had come in, fighter command called and said, you've lost one P-40, and who is it? And much to their embarrassment, they didn't know. And by that time, the airplanes were well all along on their mission, and the fighter control was trying to get in touch with them by radio and get them to make a count and see who was there and who wasn't, because they didn't know who was missing. Anyway, it caused a good deal of fuss, and I guess they were very embarrassed to have fighter command be the ones to tell them they were missing somebody and not even know it themselves, and they were anxious to establish the identity of the missing person as quickly as they could. They told me all this that night. And, my God, I was in that hospital for 2 weeks. And every day, people from the squadron came down with candy. Where in the world they got it, I don't know. Candy was a scarce commodity. But they found it, and they'd bring candy down there and chewing gum. And even some enlisted men from the squadron came, people I didn't even know. I didn't know who they were at all. But they'd come and bring mail to me and sit and chat, and I didn't want to ask them who they were. I knew they were from the squadron somewhere, but mechanics, I guess. And, well, the long and short of it was that I was got royal treatment all the time I was in the hospital, with constant stream of visitors and presents and things. It was all very heartwarming. And the line chief came down once with some pictures of the crash, which I still have, which he said he stole from the service squadron. The service squadron is the outfit that's responsible for gathering up wrecks and salvaging what they can from them and so on. But I had no complications or problems medically. And after, and towards the last, the doctor would let me get up and walk around much of the day. And finally he agreed to let me go back to duty. I had, in the meantime, made friends with some of the infantrymen who were there in the tent with me. There must have been at least 30 or 40 people in that tent, I'll bet. Anyway, when it came time to go home, I didn't have any way to get back to the squadron, which was a good 10 miles or more from the hospital. And my head was still in bandages completely. But there was a warrant officer, infantry warrant officer, and he was leaving the hospital the same day I was, and they were coming to get him in a jeep, and he said that he would drive me back to the squadron if I would agree to take him down to the strip and show him a P-40 up close. He wanted to see one. So, of course, that was easily enough agreed to, and he and his driver and I went down to 17 Mile, and I took him over to one of the P-40s, and after talking to the crew chief, we started the engine, let him see what that sounded like and all that. And eventually this nice man took me back to the camp and left me and went his way. I never saw him again. I might read a few entries from my diary of those first few days in the hospital just to give you an idea of what it was like, or what I wrote at the time. This is the first day. After supper, Nick, Sutcliffe, Smitty, Myers, and Vaudry came in. Next day, Claude, Jean, and Dick Schmaltz came in the morning. was glad to see them. In the afternoon, the chaplain, Tapper, and another guy came by, and after that, Major Martin. Felt better today, but still sore and utterly worn out. Still can't open my left eye. Next day, better today, left eye partly open. A sergeant came by with my mail. Then Sergeant Evans, Sergeant Laird, Sergeant Tracy. Later, Nick, House, and Sutliff came in, and after supper, Smitty, Spears, and Myers. Next day, better today, read quite a bit. Quinlivan, Slocum, Hayes, and Carl came in just before supper. Major Martin in the afternoon, Vaudry and Arthur after supper. Next day, very good today, Major Monroe, he was the surgeon who operated on me, came in and took the stitches out of my head. Says I'll have to stay in bed 2 weeks. Smitty, Green, Stanton, and McDerris all stopped by for a few minutes after supper. Later, Claude, Gene, Schneider, Snuff, Dorton came by. Had a good visit with them, though one of the infantrymen came in and stole my visitors much too much, and I didn't get to see as much of them as I wanted to. It's a wonder I wasn't spoiled rotten. Maybe I was. Even the Allison man came to see me one day. The first full day I was back with the squadron, of course I was far from being in shape to fly again. I went with Smitty and somebody, and we took a jeep and went over to the anti-aircraft battery. The one that the two boys were from, who came down to the crash site and dragged me up to the ambulance and so forth. And although the two boys were very modest about what they had done and were perhaps a little embarrassed at my thanks, I could tell they were also very pleased that I had come to see them and thank them for what they'd done. It was at this time that somebody in group headquarters or someplace cooked up the scheme for sending me and some of the other guys in the squadron down to Australia for what they conceived to be rest and recreation. I phrase it that way because they sent us down to a town on the northeast coast of Australia called Mackay, M-A-C-K-A-Y. It was an isolated place, and the Air Corps had set up this sort of entertainment center, but there wasn't a damn thing in the world to do at this place. Absolutely nothing. It was, the weather wasn't warm enough to go swimming, as I remember. And there was simply nothing to do. And a couple of us decided we would, there was a commercial airline that flew out of there. And we made reservations. We were just going to go AWOL, so to speak, and go down to Sydney or someplace. But I reckon the commanding officer was on to that little ruse, and I suppose the airline people told him or something, but he found out about it anyway and called us in, and he said, I canceled your reservations, and I don't want any more of this attempting to leave here. Well, it wasn't much fun, and but what really was bad about it was the fact that while I was there, I got pink eye, of all things, and that was miserable for 3 or 4 days. That's about all it lasted. I do remember, though, that a couple of ladies, married ladies from the town, found out somehow that I liked classical music, and one of them had a phonograph with records, opera records and things, and damned if they didn't invite me over for dinner one night and played records for me all evening long, which was very nice thing to do. And if I hadn't had pink eye, I would have enjoyed it even more than I did. One thing we got there, I must say, was fantastically good food. Of course, any food at all compared to what we'd been having would have been fantastically good, just about. But we had all the eggs we wanted, and ham and steak and milk and butter and whatnot, and that was all quite splendid. Well, after about 2 weeks or something, let's see how long it was. We got there on March the 7th and left on March the 22nd, so it wasn't too bad. Flew back up to Port Moresby in an airplane most people nowadays have never seen. And that is, it was a B-17C, C like Charlie. That was an early model B-17, and so early that it was never used in combat in World War II that I know of. Certainly not, except maybe in the beginning months. But somehow they had this old B-17C, and they had ripped all the insides out of it and made it up like a transport for people. And they were using it to fly personnel here and there and the other place. And we flew back up to Port Moresby in that B-17. About the time I got back from the hospital, or soon after, I believe, the squadron got a bunch of new pilots. Young guys, I don't know how many, five or six of them, I suppose, who had been come to us from Hawaii, where they had been flying P-40s. And all of them, I guess, I got eventually, of course, to know quite well. One of them, you will hear a lot about, was named Jack Farrell, F-A-R-R-E-L-L. His first name was actually Jackson, spelled J-A-X-O-N, and he was a Mormon from Salt Lake City, a slim, red-haired boy. And I remember he told me once that there was a great statue of Brigham Young out on the mountain outside of Salt Lake City. Well, that's true, there is. And that on the base of this monument, Brigham Young's first words on seeing the Great Salt Lake Valley, these words were inscribed on the base of the monument. That's true, too. But he said, and I was fool enough to believe it, he said Brigham Young had said, "This looks like a great place for fishing and fucking, and I don't see any fish." And I fell for that stupid story. The first time I remember seeing Jack Farrell was one day when he was quite new and I was not doing anything because I still had my head bandaged up. And I was officer of the day. Well, some of the boys came up and said that they were going down to Port Moresby Harbor and we were going out on a launch and go swimming and lie in the sun and have a nice time, and they wanted me to go. But I couldn't go because I was officer of the day. And it was Jack Farrell who came up to me, and I didn't know him from Adam, except I knew he was one of the new guys, and said, "I'll take over for you if you want to go." And I thought that was very nice of him, and I accepted. I just agreed, and I did. I went, and we had a marvelous time. We went out, and this launch was run by a sergeant, and he took us out to a little island out in the harbor. And this was water that I bet you could see 30 feet to the bottom, count every pebble. And he anchored off the island a little bit, beautiful sand, and said, "You can swim all you want between the boat and the island, but don't swim out on the far side of the boat. It's not safe because of sharks." And I don't remember that any of us questioned his advice. Anyway, we had a lovely day out there, lying in the sun and swimming in this warm, warm, beautiful, clear water. And it was a great day. I remember that. And that's the first time I remember having anything to do with Jack Farrell. Well, at this point in time, as people like to say nowadays, the Allies had pretty well taken the eastern part of New Guinea, including the north coast, and that meant that it was safe over there, comparatively speaking. I've already told you the problems we had trying to keep patrols over the infantry because we always had to go home early because the weather invariably got bad towards the middle of the afternoon or sometimes sooner. And the only way we could get home was to leave early, and this left the infantry open to Japanese fighters, which came down and strafed and bombed them and made a nuisance of themselves. Well, by this time, we had taken Buna, and the Allies, Americans really, were busy setting up a big base over there on the north side of the mountain at a place called Dobodura, D-O-B-O-D-U-R-A. Most people called it Dobo. And they had one dirt strip there, which was a huge thing. Very long and very wide, and it was no pavement or anything on it. It was just grass, nothing but grass. But it was wide enough that I have on more than one occasion seen four P-38s take off abreast all at the same time off of that strip. That's how wide it was. This was the big strip over there, and there were others as well around here and there. And the decision was made to move the 49th Fighter Group in toto over to Dobodura. And the 7th Squadron was to be, the 7th Squadron was to be the first one over, but that's not right because I remember for a fact that the 8th Squadron was over there before we were. Anyway, there were some other strips over there, one metal strip, and then they were busy building another strip, which we, the 7th Squadron, were to use when we moved over there. And this strip, the only one I know of at the time over there, which was asphalt or something like it, was a paved blacktop strip cut right out of the jungle. And very good strip it was, too, and we were almost the only people that ever used it, though I do remember a couple occasions when B-25s flew off of it. Anyway, the business was that the 7th Squadron was going to move to Dobodura, which, you see, would allow fighters to patrol over there and stay up until dark, if necessary. And it also meant that we could escort bombers and transports and be a great deal closer to the point of departure and the point of return than we were over at Port Moresby. Port Moresby by this time was a sort of way off from anybody. And you had to fly a long way to get from Port Moresby to any place where you might need to go, like a Japanese target. Well, I wasn't feeling terribly well at this time. I had a little problems with rheumatism and problems with my teeth and problems with this and that and the other thing. Probably psychosomatic, who knows. anyway, I did. And my head wasn't entirely healed up either. And Captain Manning, who was the squadron commander, took it into his head that he would move me over to Dobadura to be in charge of an advanced detail of enlisted men we had over there who were building our new camp. The 8th Squadron was already over there, and the 49th Group headquarters were already over there. So, about the middle of April, no, early in April, I packed up my belongings and was taken over to Dobradura in a C-47, and was sent to group headquarters to live for the time being. Wow. This is a good place to end this tape.